All right, my name is Julie Hofstetler, and I am interviewing Dr. Jim Dunn, and he is the president of Oklahoma Wesleyan. Jim, could you just briefly introduce yourself, give a little bit of background information?
Sure. Yeah, my name's Jim Dunn, president at Oklahoma Wesleyan University. I've been here since June 1st of 2019, so in my third year as president. And by previous trade, I've never worked for a university before, but I've been a pastor of a local church, a denominational leader, and a consultant to churches all over the United States. So I'm actually an alum of Oklahoma Wesleyan. I was a freshman on this campus in 1984, back when the dinosaurs roamed around.
Wonderful. Could you speak a little bit about your experience as a student at Oakwood?
Yeah, the campus was quite a bit smaller as far as the buildings and the student body when I was a student here. There were a lot of students associated with the Wesleyan denomination, more than there are now. And at the same time, it was a great experience. I was a student athlete here. And
what did you play?
Basketball. Well, playing is an overstatement. I was on the team. I didn't play very much. It was a great experience. A lot of good friends still that serve around the world in various capacities. I minored in business here. And that is something that has really come back to help me in many different places and times. And went on from here to seminary at Asbury Theological Seminary in Wilmore, Kentucky. And earned a Master of Divinity there, and then pastored, and then earned a Doctorate of Ministry from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Deerfield, Illinois, Chicago. And anyway, the foundation that I received here in the liberal arts framework with working on a ministry major and a business minor was really something that set me up for success later. And trying to replicate that now for every student that comes through now.
Do you have a favorite memory or a funny story or just anything you like to reflect on as your time as a student here?
Yeah, I can remember very frankly and vividly a couple of chapel services that I made a deeper commitment to Christ in. That chapel, we didn't have the chapel building that we have now. Our chapels were in the gym. It was very echoey, very noisy. Back when students carried books, they would drop books on wooden bleachers, and it was terrible. But I can remember two or three chapels, and I could remember the speakers, actually. One guy's name was Paul, and just the impact that that had. Some of the funny stuff, I was the idea guy for pranks. And so you just needed a kind of a gullible friend in your group that would think that your ideas were just outstanding and amazing, and then they would actually carry them out so you wouldn't have to. So one of the pranks we pulled, actually on the president in this building, so I deserve every prank I ever get as president, was they had renovated a dorm and a dorm bathroom. And they left a commode out and didn't throw it away or didn't take it away. So I decided that that would be kind of fun to, you know, replace the president's chair with a commode. And so sure enough, somebody overheard me. I didn't do it. I wasn't involved in it. I didn't break into the office to do it. But they replaced the president's chair with a commode. And the worst part of that prank was nobody that did it could remember where they put the president's chair. And so he came in, and apparently it was quite a ruckus. I wasn't also dumb enough to return to the scene of any crime. So I don't know what all the response was. So apparently he hollered pretty loudly. And then another one, we used to have a flashing arrow sign up at the top of the hill of the campus, the entry. And the entry actually was the south entrance. There wasn't, the north entrance, not the south entrance. That was the only place you could get on campus with a car. So they had this flashing welcome sign, you know, back in the day when they couldn't afford decent signs. So we would go out in the middle of the night and make the letters say something else. And the president at the time lived on that corner of that entry in the housing addition next door, and there was a gate. And I don't know why he would have been up at this point in time. I don't know how he heard anything. So we were rearranging the letters to say something that it probably shouldn't have said. And I feel this tap on my shoulder, and I could hear that president's voice. And he was actually at my inauguration, so it's all good. But he had a raspy voice. Would you like to change the letters back now, or would you like to see the dean of students tomorrow? We're changing them right now. Somebody really met him, said something that shouldn't have said. We're changing them back right now. So those are just a couple of things that we also swam in his pool one night, unwelcome. We toilet papered professor's yards. The key to that one was you yelled out somebody's name who wasn't there. If you saw movement or lights, you yelled out somebody else's name who was not in the group. That was the signal to get out of Dodge and get in your car and take off.
That's very smart.
We were, busy.
So did you ever see yourself coming back to Oakwu as an administrator or a teacher or in any way involved in Oakwu?
I really didn't. I did come back to serve on the Board of Trustees and was invited.
What year did you start that?
2004.
Okay.
And so I became a denominational executive, and typically, the executives, it's kind of like being a vice president of the whole denomination. There were four of us, and we were all appointed to a board. And typically, if you went to a school, they would appoint you to that school because you'd have familiarity with it. Mm-hmm. And so I did come back and do that. I taught a little bit in some like online classes, ordination classes for the university.
For the school of ministry?
Mm-hmm, for the school of ministry. And no, I didn't see myself coming back. I'm not from this part of the country. And I have an older sister that lives here, and that's about it. When they asked me to consider this position, I actually laughed at the person who asked me. And I have no pedigree, no traditional route to be a university administrator in anything that I've done. And so it was something I felt compelled to do and had prayed quite a bit about it. And my wife felt the same way. And so we allowed our name to go through the process. And thankfully, I wasn't unemployed. I was very happily doing what I was doing. I was a consultant, literally, to a pool of 10,000 churches. I didn't work with 10,000, but it could be something where they could have accessed that service. But anyway,
for the Wesleyan Church,
and the Church of the Nazarene.
Okay.
And a network of churches called ARC Network, yeah. ARC. And so I worked for a foundation, and it was a free consultation kind of thing just to help churches get more on mission and leadership things with their boards and what have you. So we felt like we should consider it. I was able to be myself and say what I needed to say, not to sabotage it, but I didn't need to dance around it to somehow secure a job.
So you kind of alluded to this a little bit. When did you hear that, first hear that Oakwu's previous president, Dr. Piper, was retiring? And what was kind of your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so I was surprised. His contract was to go through the summer of 2020. And we were in a boardroom, and it was actually this room that you're interviewing me in. And I was in it. I was on the executive committee of the board, and he announced his retirement in the fall board meeting of 2018. And that's when I first heard it. And so three or four, I'd have to think how many, there's only eight on that committee, on that executive committee of the board. And I know at least three, as I was walking to my car, asked if they could walk with me And they asked me if I would consider it. Wow. Well, that 15 minutes later.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So when they asked you, when you kind of, again, alluded to this earlier, did you immediately think that this is something that you wanted, or did it take you a while to kind of come around to it?
I told them I would pray about it, which was a pretty big step for me because I'm usually yes or no. And I've had, you know, it's not, I mean, there's a certain period of your life where others think that they want you to join their cause and their team. And usually my answer is no, pretty quickly. I just don't see it. I don't sense it. I don't feel it. So if I say to somebody, I'll pray about it, that is an entry into that conversation. But I told them not to call me for 3 months and don't even talk to me. I need time to pray. I need time for my wife to pray. And so they honored that. And then I think the day the 3 months let out, they ended, they called. And so we felt compelled. They said they wanted me to be considered. I found out later there were over 100 people that wanted this job, and or at least applied. And they got it down to 19 somehow. Then they got it down to 8. Then they got it down to 4. Then they got it down to 2. And every one of the in that 19, I think this is right. Once, and I didn't know this at the time, but I'm the only one that didn't have any higher ed administration experience. So. Yeah, it's either, you know, amazing or really dumb to hire me.
Could you tell me a little bit about the interview process that you and your wife, Wendy, went through?
Yeah, so there was a search committee that was formed by the board. They did an internal committee. Some universities hire what others would call a headhunter and try to do a really broad search. They did a broad search, but they ran it amongst themselves as a board. And they had a really experienced board member who had done this before to actually find my predecessor who chaired it. And they asked him to do it again. And it's a lot of work. So there were written kinds of questions that they asked to respond. There were phone calls that search committee would do. They would break it up. I had two members of the search committee interview me by phone. They then got into like, what would you do if you were president kinds of questions beyond, for us, beyond mission kinds of things like doctrine and what would your viewpoint be on this particular issue? Maybe it's a social kind of struggle or, you know, what's your theology or what's your perception of scripture toward this social ill? They actually asked a few questions comparing what my predecessor would do. Like, do you agree with what your predecessor did on, you know, a certain topic that he might have said something or written something about? And that was interesting because I really don't want to compare anything. And I don't think they just asked me that. But since I was on the board, I knew what some of those things were. And I knew the good and maybe some of the struggles with those things. And so I'm sure there's people that have struggled with things that I write and say on occasion as well. So I tried not to malign, but again, I wasn't unemployed. I didn't need a job. And I just said, here's what I think should have happened. And I was never allowed to compare myself with my brothers and sisters when I was a little kid. And I just don't like it. So that was part of it. Then they got into references. And so they, as you moved along, if you made the cut, I guess, then they got into deeper things. And so there was somebody that was, I think, a clinical psychologist that wanted to talk to me. There was a theological interview. There was a conversation about personal things like marriage. There was a credit check. There was then Personal reference, professional reference, academic reference, obviously getting into, you know, making sure your education is legit. The history of the university has a president who claimed that he had a PhD from a school in California and never went to that school. So that was found out after he was elected years and years ago, more than 40 years ago. But anyway, then they got into asking the persons that were references for anybody that either side really liked you or didn't like you and wanted their names and contact info. So wanted people that had worked with you before, maybe on your staff. And at one point I had a staff of about 46 people. They wanted all those names. I found out after the whole process that they had literally talked to over 125 people about me. And, you know, typically somebody might call that a 360. They had a set of questions. And, you know, even people that I had fired, they wanted to talk to just to see what I was like. And then you come in the final round. The way they did it was they had a weekend where the other candidate came in and met some folks. And then, that candidate actually backed out right before the final.
I think I remember this. I think this is when they brought the faculty in.
Right.
Told us what was going on.
Right. So I'm not sure. He called me actually and said, I'm dropping out. And I said, I wish you wouldn't, because I think they need a choice. And he just said, I don't feel called to do it. And he was very courteous about it and kind. He didn't owe me that at all. I didn't even know who he was. And so anyway, he had visited the campus and then decided to drop out for some reason. And then I came in for pretty much the final round. Did a town hall in our satellite campus in Tulsa with the employees there, literally within a half hour of landing at the airport, which was fine. And then the next day met with faculty and staff, and they actually handed out some kind of hard copy survey to every employee and wanted feedback from what they heard or what they thought. I prepared a packet of who I was, who Wendy was, what I had done, anything that I had done that might have been academic, whether it was authorship or teaching, or someone questioned my doctorate and thought it was honorary. And so I listed the courses and things that, kind of like a transcript. And then a philosophy approach, how I deal with people, what I think about leadership. I ranked myself on what I'd be good at and what I wouldn't be good at. I gave sample articles that I had written. I had a twice a month blog that I wrote for about 12 years and provided samples of that. Avita, resume, the whole deal. Tried to be as open and transparent as possible and gave that to every employee when they came to those meetings, and then met with the search committee again. And then at some point in time, the whole board was brought in physically on campus and had a discussion with me out of the room and an election. And so in the spring of 2019 is when they voted.
And what was your first thought when you got the call, or when a board member came out and told you that you were it and you were the president?
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually was telling somebody this the other day. My first thought was, I better pray because I have no idea what I'm doing. It really was. And I call those hokey Pete moments. I don't even know what that means or where it comes from, but it's like, what in the world did you just agree to? And I knew I was supposed to do it. I knew God was leading me to do it, but I'm still learning 3 years in what governance should be. And, I knew how to relate to people. I wasn't worried about that, but you know, what was this going to be like? And can we help the school be successful again? And will I be able to take care of employees the way that I want to? And, you know, I didn't fear being accepted. Every job I have ever had, except for one, I was voted on so far by outside people and inside people. So I was kind of used to that and used to some of the scrutiny that leaders go through, fairly or unfairly. But the only other job I had that I wasn't voted on, I was a shoeshine locker room attendant at Hillcrest Country Club here in town while I was a student. I got fired after the first day. It's the only job I've been fired from so far.
So when did you and Wendy, your wife, move to Bartlesville? So you got elected in spring of 19, and yep. Then you guys were here pretty quickly?
We moved right after Memorial Day in the summer of 2019. So I started June 1st. We moved in the week before. So within really about 8 months of hearing about it, we were on the job.
What were some of your initial thoughts just in your first few days of about the campus, about the students, about faculty?
Yeah. I remember parking, you know, in the president's parking space and reading that sign and just praying, like, I don't know what to think about this. And it wasn't anything that I doubted what I was supposed to do. I don't know everything. And so the first person I met was actually one of our groundskeepers here, and he was mowing, and it was pretty early in the morning. And I was walking toward the building where my office is, and I knew where that office was because I was on the board. I'd been in that office, and he stopped his mower and he said, "Hey, what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm just going in the building here." He said, "Well, we just don't let anybody just walk around here. It's about 7 in the morning, you know, and things really don't start here till 8. So you need to wait if you're meeting with somebody. We just don't allow just anybody to wander into a building." And I said, "Okay." And I just kept walking. And he's like, "I'm serious. I'm going to have to call campus safety." And I said, that's fine. And he just looked at me and he said, "Wait a minute." And he said, you're the new... "Never mind." And he literally took his mower and walked off. I never said anything to him, ever. He's not working here anymore. I had nothing to do with his dismissal. He took another job somewhere else. But that was my first greeting on campus, having been elected president when I was on the job. It was perfect for memoirs. We don't allow just anybody here.
Yeah, that's the name of your book.
That's right. That's right.
So how does your pastoral experience, how do you think it's prepared you for taking on this job? You don't have any higher ed experience, but no. You have a lot of pastoral experience. How right. has that prepared you for this job?
Yeah, I explain it this way, and that is that there are multiple constituents when you're a pastor. So you have people and boards, actually, that you have to work with that are on the flow chart, they're above you. And you actually have to lead them, and yet you're, accountable to them. You also have the constituent, obviously, of members of your congregation. In our system, in the Wesleyan Church, they vote on you every so often, usually every 4 years. If they vote on a lesser year interim, that's usually not a good sign. You could be voted out at any given time by a 2/3 majority. And so you also have this whole element of new people that you're trying to reach. You have budget issues, you have property issues, you have HR issues if you have a staff. You have legal issues if you have to terminate someone. There's always, if you're growing, there's needs of how do you get innovative and, you know, capitalize on everything that you need to do and yet not overdo it and really put, you know, a difficult financial margin or burden on the church or ministry. And then when I went into the denominational life, that just increased 10 times more. And then my audience actually was at a distance. Because I didn't have a local congregation. And so all of these things really, in my mind, were preparation for how to deal with people, how to deal with programs, and I call it how to deal with pennies. And so it's just another step, and it's a big one. I managed about $7 million a year when I was in my denominational role and was responsible for that. This one is, you know, double that, a little more than double that. I had 50, close to 50, 46, 48 staff in one role for 12 years. And in this one, there's about 150 employees. I had directors before, I have vice presidents and cabinet. There's some, and it, you know, you have donors, you have students, you have recruiting, you have kind of an outreach element, if you will. You also have an internal culture that has to be healthy. And so I've been surprised at how many parallels there are. But the one thing that actually I've tried to improve quite a bit is helping at a university level the board understand their role, because we didn't. Helping the cabinet and the vice presidents and the administration understand their role, helping the faculty understand their role. And I mean, kind of like a church, everybody has an opinion about what that should be. I think, I don't know that you asked this, but probably some of the bigger learning curves are just, I call them prosperity gaps. So it's essentially, you know, what you have and yet what you would like to become and what it will take. And it's not necessarily all money. It's also people and leaders. And, you know, so if you had a big gap in, you know, your enrollment process, like what's it going to take to improve that? And change that, and can you change it, and how long does it take, and who are the players in that, and you know, will the board support that? I mean, it's so many factions, and they don't have to be divisive. It's just a lot of different audiences and constituents. So I know it's not an academic term, but I call it a jigsaw puzzle, and quite frankly, I don't like puzzles, so.
What has been your best day as president and your worst day as president?
Best day for me personally is when a student gets it. And what I mean by that is, even seated where you're at right now, student came in last year and said, I want to pray to accept Christ as my Savior. And so I'm a pastor, and that's why I exist, to get people on the right path in life. And so we prayed the sinner's prayer, and he accepted Christ, and I told him he had to call his mom, and she did, and he did. She called me, and just happy as could be. And, you know, when somebody gets it, so that was a spiritual moment. But it's also when a kid, you know, finds out what God's really wired them to do, and they get to come to peace with that. And, you know, our profs and coaches work with them, and they'll even stop me on campus and talk to me about how they feel like God's leading them, and they're changing their major perhaps, or I know I'm supposed to teach, and even though somebody told me I'd never make any money teaching, I know I'm supposed to do it. And those are the best days for me. And then I think also when I can introduce someone to the university that doesn't know anything about us, and, you know, that could be a prospective student and their parents, could be a new donor, could be just even somebody from the community, to let them know who we are, what we try to do. And so those are really good days. The hardest days are when I'll use the word unfairly or just ignorantly critique. You know, when you have the multiple constituents, and you have to make decisions, or you say something, somebody wants to overinterpret that. Those are hard days, and nobody says it's fair, but it just hurts. And so there's days when you feel all alone, you know, I admit pretty regularly that I don't know what to do. That's not a crutch. I seriously don't know what to do some days. And, you know, you don't know who to talk to. You don't know who can handle even a really cumbersome conversation. There's different audiences that you should never talk in. You know, you shouldn't share that with students for sure. And sometimes you don't even know those closest to you higher up the food chain if they can handle different conversations. And so even a board can't always handle a conversation at times. So you really have to, you know, in my case, my preference is a reliance on God and a lot of prayer. And I have friends that I can run stuff by. But when somebody goes after you, almost just because they want to or they think they have a right to, and it really isn't, you know, they're portraying something that wasn't meant at all. But, you know, people that want it, I call it people that actually, I use this in church life quite a bit. And somebody would ask me like, well, what are they like? I said, well, you need to know they have a medical condition. Like, oh, what's that? And it, you know, it's like, sounds horrible, but I call it having spoons disease. And so it literally is the constant need to stir, you know, and just can't give anybody the benefit of the doubt. Can't understand anything about if you're trying to be gracious to a student or to a staff member, a faculty member. And apparently they've never had any difficulty in their life and they have all the answers. So I've said quite a bit because of personal pain that I can usually tell if somebody hasn't had any pain to deal with. And I've also said it not in an egotistical way, that I can usually tell if somebody hasn't led anything. And they have really bizarre comments. And it's like, yeah, you've probably not led very much, huh? And you just wouldn't say that if you had. So it's the unwarranted, unmerited critique. But they happen, and it's part of it.
Being a public figure.
Yeah.
We're going to move on to questions more specifically about COVID, but is there anything, and you can say no, but is there anything else that you'd like to tell me about being president of Oklu or anything you wish I would have asked about your
presidency? One thing that I've been really pleased with, which could change tomorrow, right, based on one decision, is the sense that I get that we're building more and more collaboration and teamwork and, you know, looking at the success of the whole school. You know, anything that requires delivery today is changing. It's not just higher ed. I could talk about church life all day long because I'm more familiar with it. But McDonald's is figuring out how to deliver something differently. And so I'm hoping that the collaboration that we're building, which involves trust, that just you constantly have to work at, and I have to go first in that. I get that. And it's not always fun because that's when some of the bullets come out, you know, and some of the darts, and that's normal, but somebody has to go first. You can't just sit around twiddle your thumbs and stare at each other and say, what are we going to do? But I'm hoping that we can keep that teamwork into innovation and taking a look at how we deliver education. And, you know, somebody said, well, we need to expand so we can expand our revenue and increase our revenue. And I said, no, that's not the number one goal. The number one goal, believe it or not, is to increase our influence. And then things like revenue would be nice. But I really, Wendy and I both feel accepted. We've tried to be accepting, and we don't look at it as a hierarchy. We look at it more in teamwork, and we understand somebody has to make decisions. We also understand that somebody's ultimately accountable, but we try to treat the board that way. We try to treat faculty and staff and administration that way. And quite frankly, we kind of pretend that we're like a parent to some of the students or all of the students. So I'm really happy to be able to be involved in a community that hopefully, and I genuinely think they do care about what they do and each other. And that's the kind of place I want to be a part of.
Absolutely. So like I said, we're going to move on to some more questions about COVID and what it is like being a president of a university in the age of COVID. Do you remember when you first heard about the coronavirus and kind of what were some of your initial thoughts about it?
Yeah, I was speaking at a conference in Florida the week that the World Health Organization was rumoring about this pandemic, and literally was speaking three times a day. And it was Monday, Tuesday. We were coming back Wednesday. I think I started Sunday. Anyway, we were coming back Wednesday night and just trying to watch the news. I couldn't catch, you know, certain segments and what in the world's going on, and started getting phone calls from the campus leaders. And then literally my board meeting was coming in. And so I had to get back to prepare for that. It started that night, Wednesday night. And then the pandemic is announced by the World Health Organization on Thursday morning. I'm in board meetings. I'm getting texts and notes, flying down the table at me. And, you know, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? From everybody. And, you know, we're kind of cloistered in this boardroom. And there were differences of opinion about what you should do. And, you know, what if this is a conspiracy? I mean, it reminded me of some feelings I had actually when I was a sophomore in high school and Ronald Reagan was shot. And I was actually on the golf team of my high school, and we were coming off the ninth green, and my coach came yelling, "The president's been shot. The president's been shot." I was a sophomore in high school, and I just remember thinking, man, I don't even know what's going on. I don't even know how to respond. And I kind of had that flashback, you know, it's a similar thing on 9/11. Like, okay, I don't know how this affects me, but I'm pretty sure it does, and I don't know what it means. And
feeling vulnerable and not even knowing why.
Yeah. And what do I do? And everybody's looking to make a decision, and you're not going to always make the right decision. And so I literally gathered our cabinet together that morning. And I think that was Friday morning. Anyway, gathered the cabinet and said, call a town hall. We're shutting down this afternoon. And so we thought that, you know, we had spring break the next week. And so we thought that would be good. Just get everybody out of here, get them home, get them safe, whatever that means. You know, it's clear around the world in China, but apparently it's coming like a train here. And so some people thought that was way over dramatic and drastic. And I stood in front of the, you know, student body specifically. I presume there were other employees in the room, and just said, we're going to have to close. And I told them, actually, that we would be better because of this experience. And I didn't even know if I believed that, but that's what I said. And I mean, you have to be, right? I mean, it's just horrible. And told them we'd be back by Easter, which I think was about 3 or 4 weeks away. And everything will be fine. You'll be better because of this. We got to grow through this. We got to be safe. And we're closing down. And so obviously it was a lot more than 4 weeks. And one of the worst things that happened that spring for me as a dad was knowing how far our students live away from here. Some don't, but a lot do. We didn't tell them to take their stuff home for spring break. There's no way they're moving out of their room in one afternoon or whatever. And so they all had to come back by appointment. And if they could at all, some of the rooms we boxed up. Our student development staff boxed them up and stored them, all their stuff, so we could clean the rooms in the summer. Anyway, we went online. It was a huge inconvenience for professors, and we weren't ready for that. And tried to give as much grace as we could to employees, faculty, students, just to get through this. I think we had 41 days left in the semester. And there were some other ramifications as well that were really difficult to deal with.
So did you look at other university presidents? Did you talk to other university presidents? What was your experience?
Yeah, so having worked in the denomination, we have four other schools, five total. So I called, we have one in Canada. I did not call them. And I called the ones in the United States, the other three, and they said, we don't know what we're going to do. And I said, well, we're shutting down. And they said, you have no idea what you're doing. All three of them, which is true. I didn't. And they were all experienced higher ed presidents and been there for many years. And then I asked my cabinet actually to call other schools that they knew of and even schools in our region, in our athletic conference, and call as many people as you can within the next hour. We got to know what they're doing and try to see, you know, are we the only one? Or I don't like being first in much of anything because for bragging rights, but we were the first of any of those calls. We were the first ones that decided as a cabinet we were closing and how we would try to handle that. I didn't know if we were right or not. I just didn't know. A worldwide pandemic. I had heard about the Indian flu or whatever it was called a century earlier. Yeah, I had heard about that from my grandparents. And I don't know. A pandemic, pretty serious if you ask me. So let's get everybody home. And unfortunately, our international students had a really difficult time going home. And we had a young lady who was a student who actually is from Kenya who stayed with us from the time we shut down in March until the time we opened back up in August. And it was a delight to have her in her home. And I got to learn Swahili for a while.
What type of pushback did you get from shutting down, putting everything online?
So there were some internally, and rightly so, that questioned, you know, is this too drastic? Is it something that, are you sure this is necessary? You know, one of the things that was true is I hadn't done this before, and I was only 9 months into my presidency at that point. But nobody that is alive pretty much today that I know personally, especially on our campus, had ever been through this before either. So it wasn't just that, you know, having to be a president, you didn't know what you were doing, which was true. But now, how do you respond to this, you know, worldwide health threat? And there were some pretty early on that thought it was a conspiracy that somehow, some way, China was invading America. I heard that one. I was accused of gonna basically turn all of our students into Marxists if I do this. That I was told that day. And I just kept telling people, I said, listen, we're trying to do the right thing. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. We're going on spring break. We're leaving a day early. They'll be back in 10 days. It'll be okay. And just tried to keep a level head with that. And I didn't know. I don't evaluate things and ask if I'm right or wrong. I mean, if I'm wrong, I won't do something, obviously. But there's a lot of times you do stuff and you don't know if you're right. And yet you've got close to 1,000 people that you're responsible for. So what are you going to do and how are you going to mitigate anything that might happen here? And is their livelihood as well as their health in your responsibility? And so I'm going to go safe on that every time. And yet there are some that didn't like that. We actually got some pushback that was really interesting. So students are gone. We close the campus as best we can. We have some international students we have to house locally. And so we had 41 days, I think it was, where they're not using the cafeteria, the dining hall, or food service, as well as they're not staying in our dorms. And I actually had a few people tell me that we were not obligated to refund that. They signed a contract, kind of like rent. And even though they weren't going to use it, we should just not even talk about that, because they had heard me say, because we were asked by students and parents pretty quickly, what's going to happen, you know, to our meal plan that we paid for? What's going to happen to the room, you know, that we paid for the whole semester and the fees for that? And I told them pretty point blank, on the spot, like, you'll get a refund. And we did. It cost us $1 million, 41 days. And I mean, there's been some other government stimulus that, you know, came, but we didn't know that at the time. It was just the right thing to do. But I had some question, like, you're not obligated to do that. And I said, you're right. Legally, you're probably right. But morally, we're going to refund it. And so most of the students who were undergrads and not graduating that year, they actually just pushed that credit into the next fall. And that, I mean, we still lost it, but that helped us in cash flow.
Did some of the other presidents do the same thing? Was that a pretty common move to refund, or?
Yeah, the ones that I know did. Some of them did not, and actually were they faced litigation because of it, and so it's, you know, it's a tough thing when you're balancing millions of dollars and you lose, you know, a couple percent of your whole budget in one swoop. It's hard, and I can see why you wouldn't want to refund it quickly, but it's still the right thing to do. So most of the ones I know did. The biggest pushback I got was actually about graduation. So we did graduation online. Everybody's gone. We filmed it, we streamed it. I received, and I've gotten quite a few phone calls in my lifetime so far. I received the worst call I have ever gotten about anything that I've ever been associated with. I used to referee high school basketball, by the way. So I've been yelled at a bit. It was the worst, by far, the worst call I've ever gotten, because we weren't having an in-person graduation and we were robbing their precious child's experience and their accomplishment. And it's like, you still are graduating, you were just not having commencement as a ceremony. You're still graduating. And was called names that I didn't know how to respond. You know, one of the first things you have to do in conflict management is figure out if the other person is even rational, which you can kind of, you know, use in a pejorative way, but it just didn't, it wasn't merited. It wasn't fair at all. And I felt badly, and I missed my own child's graduation because it was, they didn't even have it. They didn't even stream it from grad school. So, but nothing was going to make sense to this person.
What has been the hardest thing about being the president of a university in the age of COVID?
I mean, I know it's going to sound trite, but it really is the unknown. So even like, when can we come back? What kinds of things can you do with people who've been isolated that are struggling with their mental health? That's students and employees. That's not just students. How will this change what we have to do or need to do? And will anybody recognize that the world has changed, or do they think we just go back to normalcy or what was? There's part of it that can, but I think it's just the unknowns that came into my head immediately. You know, fiscally, financially, are we ever going to thrive again? Are we ever going to see people come back to school again? I mean, everybody went into their own little hole and nobody knew when they were coming out. And so I think you have just that whole cluster of, man, there's so many unknowns in this. This is unprecedented, obviously an overused word, but it really is. And one thing that actually comforted me, which is really bizarre because it won't sound like much comfort, was I got an email from an old-time alumnus that looked up the existence of the school or one of our preceding schools during the 1918 pandemic. The school the year before was a school in Kansas, one of our preceding schools, had 200 students. And so they couldn't equate it all to the pandemic. I mean, there were some draft things and war things going on at the same time. But the next year they had 60. And some of the students died because of the virus then. And even though it's horrible and really morbid, I knew that we weren't that bad. We hadn't lost anybody yet. We have since for some graduate students, even as soon as last week. But it's something that I just, that in a really weird way actually gave me confidence that we'd be, if they could get through that, then we can get through this.
So you alluded to it a little bit just in terms of like financially and things like that, but how has COVID more specifically impacted Oklahoma Wesleyan?
You know, we opened up for on-ground in-person classes in the fall of 2020. And there were a lot of schools that didn't. And we didn't know if we were doing the right thing. We had to limit, you know, spacing, distancing. We had to require masks, which nobody liked. And I got accused of all kinds of things for that. And we were one of the only two of 13 schools that allowed spectators at our athletic events. Our whole conference shut down. We had to move a bunch of our athletic events to the spring semester instead of the fall. It was a nightmare, just all the changes, and they happened weekly. So ask your question again. Sorry.
No, how has COVID impacted Oakwu?
Yeah. Because of being on ground, it sounds really weird, but, we have actually had an increase in students. We had more transfer students because there's other schools went online that came to Oklahoma Wesleyan specifically at the Christmas transition of the semester between 2020 and 2021. But we saw an increase right before the 2020 fall semester kicked off. It was a tough semester because we went straight through without any breaks, no Labor Day, no fall break, and ended at Thanksgiving. It was really hard on everyone. Then we had 6 weeks off at Christmas, which everybody loved. But I think it actually drove a little bit more enrollment our way because we were on ground in person. It has helped us in our procedures, in our healthcare. We've had to up our game in what we do for health services here. We've also provided elements for mental health services that we haven't had before. I think for the most part, it made us work together more, made us appreciate each other more, made us understand how different decisions would affect other layers of the university. Financially, we've actually benefited from some of the stimulus and been able to designate some even things that have to do with air quality and drinking fountains and improvements that we were going to do anyway that we were able to take advantage of. It's not been fun, but it's actually, I think, made us stronger given us a little confidence, a little swagger, if you will, to be able to handle things, to know that people were committed to working together. And quite frankly, our students have been pretty amazing. You know, they, now I know I'm the president, so they're not going to give me a whole lot of grief, but I don't know that we had a whole lot of instance where they just refused to wear a mask. We may have. I think they cooperated pretty well to some not so fun, you know, restrictions. And
they're thankful for being
in
person.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah. And then I think the other outcome is to help us realize that even though it may not be everybody's preference, there is another avenue to provide influence in education. And we had to in the spring of 2019. And it wasn't a great experiment, but it also signaled that we better get ready and improve and innovate and even improve our technology, let alone our, you know, pedagogical kinds of things. And there's always going to be a preference for having a physical footprint. And yet at the same time, the world doesn't have to come to you to get the kind of influence and education that you can provide. So I think it's opened up some doors to know that we can't do business as usual. We will have a footprint, and we also need to innovate. And it definitely sped that up if we didn't know about it much.
How has COVID impacted you personally? Have you had COVID? Have your wife?
We haven't, that we know of. It's been very hard. There's one of the things that I described, and it can be physiological, but it's also emotional, is there were a few days early on in the spring of 2020 where I describe it this way. I lost my ability to think big. And so just professionally, it's heavy and it's hard and there's so many layers to it. And I would get it everywhere. I'd get it if it was something, you know, where somebody had a critique at the school. I'd get it if somebody had a critique and saw me in town as we were all, you know, bandaged up like bank robbers going to the store. I got it criticized pretty openly at church one Sunday. Just bizarre. And so, you know, that weighs on you, whether you think it does or not. And I can usually laugh most of that off. Some of it's going to be comical in a book someday, but this ability to think big about really minutiae, what are we going to do if we have an outbreak? What's going to happen if somebody dies? Or what kind of liability do we have? There's legal things in it. There's questions about whether we should take paycheck protection programs. And, you know, is the government going to have some kind of hook in us if we do that? And come to find out it's the same thing as any financial aid that we get. It's the same language. And I still get questions about that. You know, have we made a deal with the devil? And all of these comments. And you know, it's not that you want to do any of that flippantly, but it really, just the whole climate has caused our whole society to basically critique everything and to not trust anybody. And there's cause for that on occasion to question things. And somebody asked me, you know, do you follow the science? I said, if you could just tell me what it is, I'd follow it. I don't know what it is. And so you know, on the other side, for family, it's just my wife and I at home, and we had our student there from Kenya. We had some great moments that we wouldn't normally get. And I have a home office, but then I was in there 12 hours a day with Zooms and all of that stuff just to try to keep everybody going and all the meetings. But we actually eat dinner at our dining room table more because of COVID, because we valued that. And I think a lot of families experience that. my father passed away right before the pandemic broke out, and we were able to have his funeral. I can't imagine going through that with families that haven't been able to celebrate life in whatever way through this. But we've had losses. We weren't able to see family like anybody else. Both of my children graduated from grad school during COVID, weren't able to go, weren't allowed to go. But physically, we've been fine. I tell people that the 19 is how much weight I gained. The COVID-19, it really had nothing to do with the year. It's just all the snacks I was eating at home.
So what is your hope for the future of Oakwood? It's me kind of through the context of COVID or just not, just in general.
Yeah. So my hope actually is that first and foremost, we know what our mission is, what our influence can be. And I think when you go through a crisis as an organization, which this is an outside crisis forced on you, I actually think it makes you stronger. I really do. I didn't know what I was saying that day when I closed the campus and said, we'll be better for this. But it does push you together, whether you want to or not. I don't mind being with people, but I don't know if everybody always wants to be with me, which is fine. But it causes you to think differently, causes you to innovate. Before the pandemic, we weren't thriving, and we were surviving and kind of in a defensive mode, if you ask me. But regardless, I'm hoping that having had to deal with that and having had to pivot quickly will help us make decisions better and quicker than a normal kind of sequence would be without leaving anybody out, and also help us to innovate and be ready. Like, what if, I ask this all the time, what if this happens again? What are we gonna do? Hopefully it won't. Well, what if it does? You can hope all day long. And I think it's, forced us into some thinking that we wouldn't have had before. And so my hope is that we can expand our reach. Whether we expand our physical campus or not is the big question. Like, how much capital expense should you put into the machine called a university that demands money to maintain and keep up and keep going? Or should you limit that? And we're a little bit limited by space. We have some options, but not a whole lot. And should you increase that quality of what you're doing, increase the demand of what you're doing in a sense, and then also get into more digital space and online space, and therefore increase your influence and increase your revenue. So I'm hopeful that we can get through that. And really, if I'm honest, we're catching up. We're not on the cutting edge. We're just catching up because we've relied on a footprint physically, which I prefer as well, if I'm honest about that. But I also know there are students who will never come here and will never influence if we don't figure out how to do that at a distance.
How do you want history to remember you, and specifically your tenure as president of Oakwood?
So it's not anything that I tell a whole lot of people about, but I'm scared to death to fail. Mm-hmm. I don't like to fail. I don't even like talking about being fired from the country club. And it's really a bizarre thing mentally. It's not an ego thing for me. I just don't want any part of being a failure. And so, beyond that, I hope, regardless of any big decision or big project or, whatever somebody gets credit for, I don't really like it when somebody is described as, well, they really turned around the school, or they saved the school, or they led the school. Like, Seriously? Just that one person? Wow. They must be amazing. Because we need excellent professors like yourself. We need, obviously, coaches. And I mean, I don't know how to fix electricity. I need somebody that knows how to do that in our 40 buildings. So I hope, bottom line, that people know that I cared about them and did my best to help this place thrive so that they could thrive. And the majority of that care, though, isn't here. It's not physical. It's more spiritual. And I think it's a big need. I think people need encouragement. I think they need hope. I think they need love. I think that they need somebody to believe in them. And I hope that I'm remembered that way.
Final question. Mm-hmm. Stick to you on record. Braves or Astros?
Well, since you were wearing an Astros jersey, I think it's a little bit tainted. I'm still upset that the Giants lost to the Dodgers.
Oh, I don't like the Dodgers, so we can be upset about that together.
Okay. So since I traditionally would be like a NL West fan in rooting for the Giants, then I'll go for the Stros, and hopefully they're not stealing signals this year.
Yeah, you had to put that on there. Well, thank you so much, Jim. I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down and answer these questions with me.
My pleasure. Thank you.